Thanks for the introduction, Carly. It's really nice to be back at PI and in Canada. I wanted to tell you about some recent work that I've been doing with Philip and Natalia and Asher, who's another postdoc at Slack, as well as Stefania Gori, who's a professor at the University of Cincinnati. We've been looking at signals and cosmology of strongly interacting dark sectors. So I'm going to start by sort of motivating these kinds of dark sectors and talking about their cosmology for a little bit. And that will motivate a particular theoretical setup that I want to consider, and that will lead me into experimental signals. And here I'll focus mostly on signals of these models at fixed target experiments, and mention some ideas for future work at colliders. So we know there's dark matter. There's a vast array of evidence for it across many different length scales. So we know there's a dark sector, but we don't know what it's composed of. It can be as simple as a single new particle that has some small mass or a large mass, or it can be as complicated as something like our own standard model. It can have multiple states. So I want to focus for this talk on sort of dark sectors that are more complicated. There are many different states. They're not quite minimal. So the next question is whether this kind of dark sector, does it have to couple to the standard model? Can we actually observe it somehow? And to get some sense of whether it's possible, it's useful to look at the early universe and the production of dark matter in the early universe. So assuming that the dark sector and the standard model are reheated after inflation simultaneously, you start out with some large initial dark matter density that goes like the temperature cubed. So this is a huge energy density, needs to be depleted to the observed value today. And there's several ways you can do this. You can sort of categorize the different reactions that can do this for you. So the sort of the most familiar example is simply dark matter annihilation, where you have dark matter particles annihilating into either directly into the standard model, which corresponds to the standard weakly interacting, or which corresponds to the standard weakly interacting massive particle, or into some mediator that then decays to the standard model, which is called secluded dark matter. So this possibility has been studied in much detail over the last several decades, I guess now. What hasn't been considered as much is another class of reactions that go by the name of cannibalization. So in this kind of process, you have several dark matter particles annihilating into a fewer number of dark matter particles. And the simplest example of this process is this 3-2 reaction. But in general, it can be any other kind that matches this description. So these kinds of reactions were first considered by Carlson, Michalczyk, and Hall in 2012. So naively, this seems that this kind of process can take place entirely within the dark sector, and you don't necessarily need any coupling to the standard model. Turns out that this is not true, however, and the reason is very simple. So you can see that this kind of process converts dark matter rest energy, you have three particles on the right, on the left-hand side, into dark matter kinetic energy. So this one unit of mass got converted into kinetic energy for these final state particles. So this process is continually heating the dark matter bath. So what ends up happening is that if you require you obtain the correct relic abundance, dark matter freezes out with a temperature that's much too warm, and you end up with warm dark matter, which runs afoul of constraints from structure formation, for example. So warm dark matter that's moving too fast, so it will stream out of density perturbations and wash out structure on small scales. Not yet. Not in what I just described.
So you don't have to.
Well, if you don't want to couple to a standard model, we have this problem where dark matter is too warm.
Okay.
Yeah. Exactly. So this is how I'm trying to motivate coupling to a standard model. So if you don't want it to be too warm, a natural solution that's been proposed by this group of people is to allow the dark sector to exchange heat with a standard model.
Can you explain why do I see that it's too warm? Because if I make it too heavy, then it automatically depends on the temperature of what that sector is and the mass of the dark matter.
Right, so this is actually, it may become a little more clear, but what happens is that, so if this is the lightest state in the dark sector, it cannibalizes, so the temperature is actually falling much slower than in the standard model. So the dark sector gets much hotter than the standard model. At the time of freeze out, it's it's very
internal result.
Yeah, yeah. So if you want this particle to make up all of the relic abundance of dark matter, its mass needs to be like EV scale. So it's freezing out just before matter radiation equality.
So
and it doesn't have the time to redshift away. So it's much too warm. Yeah.
You'll say later, I guess, where the EV is coming from, because it's not clear at all what you just said, why it's EV, where the EV scale is coming from.
I'm going to talk about things that are much heavier than EV.
Yeah.
I'm not actually going to mention where the EV scale comes from.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it comes from the fact that the temperature evolution in the dark sector, when this reaction is present, is very slow compared to a standard model.
What am I supposed to compare this to? So what are the parameters? Because there is a cross-section for this state, for this scale, for this process, right?
That's right.
So, why is
to Hubble?
Eh?
To Hubble, you're supposed to compare it to Hubble.
So in order to get, it's comparable to the mass. I said by the mass, so it's an alpha squared over. I mean, the mass should come in there.
Yeah, I mean the.
Okay.
The, I mean this the cross section for this. This process is some alpha cubed over m to the fifth.
It's alpha cubed over m to the fifth. So this is where it's coming from.
That's right. Yeah, I mean the one EV comes from some geometric mean of M Planck and matter radiation equality, basically. This is all to say that if you don't want to run into this problem of dark matter being too hot, you need some coupling to a standard model that allows it to this dark sector to exchange heat with the standard model. So in order to get a sense of what kind of theories actually realize this possibility, it's useful to get a sense of the characteristic scales. And as you alluded to, what you want to do to figure out when freeze out happens, how much dark matter you end up having, is to compare the annihilation rate for this process with Hubble. And if you require this to have a correct relic abundance, you can solve this for the relationship between the coupling and the mass of a dark matter. And if equilibrium between the static model and the dark sector exists, then for dark matter mass, for dark matter couplings of order one, you find that the correct relic abundance is obtained for masses of around a QCD scale. So a strong coupling implies a strong-like mass.
This excludes the whip miracle. So it excludes the whip miracle.
Well, this doesn't exclude the. This is just an alternative paradigm. But this is parametrically, this is different than the whip miracle. So to get the whip miracle estimate, where's the?
Job is right there.
You wanted me to write in there? I can mention this again towards the end. I have some stuff in the backup slides. So for WIMP miracle, the cross section, you parameterize the cross section as alpha m squared, and then you compare this to you compare the annihilation rate to Hubble. And this, if you put in a weak coupling for this cross section, you find that the dark matter mass is, let's say, 100 GeV or something. This is a WIMP miracle. This is parametrically different because you have n squared. You have two powers of a number density appearing because it's a process with three particles in initial state. The cross section is also parametrically different. So this is a strongly interacting massive particle miracle. Miracle is a strong word. It's really just a parametric coincidence. And you get this, basically. So this motivates a certain kind of scale, but again, this motivation is contingent on you picking order one couplings. But originally, this is what motivated people to look at models with strong interactions. or equivalently confining age groups. So this is what I want to talk about. This is kind of dark sector that I want to focus on, where you have some PCD-like theory in the dark sector. I'm going to specialize to SU3 cross SU3 global symmetry with an SUN confining SU3 gauge group. This is this doesn't have to be the case. You can look at other models as well with SPN or ON gauge groups as well. But this allows me to use a lot of the intuition that we have from QCD and use the notation, essentially. So below confinement, this is a theory of pions, pseudonumber Goldstone bosons, as well as their higher excitations of vector mesons. You can write down Lagrangian, and you find that the interactions that are interesting for us involve the vector mesons V and the dark matter pions pi, as well as some pion self-interactions involving either even number of pions or odd numbers of pions. So this, for example, is precisely the kind of vertex that gives rise to this cannibalization reaction that people wanted to realize. I guess just as an aside, everywhere in this talk, the pions are dark matter pions, not the standard model pions, as well as same holds for the vector mesons. So if the pions are stable, then they can make up the dark matter.
There's a mass, so it's not an exact symmetry of the SUN cross SUN.
Yeah, that's right. So there's...
the usual...
Yeah, yeah. Are you asking about stability?
No,
I don't. Is there an anomaly?
If you're not careful with your charge assignments, there is an anomaly.
But you can avoid having it.
That's right. So you can either prevent dark matter from decaying either by choosing masses in such a way that unstable states are heavier than the stable ones, or you can pick a theory with an unbroken symmetry that protects the lightest states. Effectively, there's some G parity at low energies that makes the pion stable.
And again, so far you have not assumed there's no light gauge boson, there is no coupling to the standard model, for example.
So far, I haven't assumed a coupling to the standard model, as Mina pointed out. And so there's no way to exchange heat, there's no way to detect this, really, other than this gravitational effects. So in order to implement this coupling, you can consider different kinds of options. A reasonable start is to consider the possibility that's kind of akin to what we have in the standard models, where we have some a U1 gauge symmetry, so there's some dark QED in the dark sector, so the dark sector quarks are charged under this new gauge symmetry, which kinetically mixes with the standard model photon. So this means that the pions at low energies after confinement pick up some coupling to standard model by exchange of this dark photon A prime. And the coupling to the standard model is parametrized by, in the usual way, by this kinetic mixing epsilon as well as the dark sector coupling E dark.
Is the hidden sector gapped or is there a massless state there?
It's gapped, yeah. Yeah, so the pions are the lightest states in the sector and they have some mass that depends on the couplings. If you want to reproduce a correct relic abundance, it's fixed by the couplings, essentially.
So, why haven't they seen these high particles at the LHC?
Well, they're dark states. They would escape a detector, right?
Will they ever see them?
I hope so. I mean, that's what the last two-thirds of his talk are about. Not at the LHC, but at the X-target experiments. But sort of the mass scales that I want to consider are sort of sub-GeV. Sub-GeV particles are really hard to see at LHC just because they would get lost in hadronic garbage. So it's sort of clean environments like fixed target experiments and E plus E minus colliders are probably better approaches to looking for this kind of dark sector. But I'll talk in much more detail about that later on. So the other important coupling that this gauging of this dark U1 introduces is a mixing between the dark sector vector mesons and the dark photon. This is analogous to a rho meson photon mixing in the standard model. And this will give rise to some of the visible signals that I want to talk about later on. So the really nice thing about this class of theories is that they have a sort of a finite parameter space with respect to this coupling to the standard model, this epsilon, which looks kind of like this. So I'm going to show many plots where you have a dark photon mass on the x-axis with the other masses terms fixed by some mass ratios and the coupling to the standard model on the y-axis. So the requirement of having kinetic equilibrium, having a scattering rate that's large enough, essentially rules out the lower half of this parameter space. So viable models of dark matter have to live around here or above a certain coupling. So this sets some like minimal signal that you can see in your experiments. So maybe this will clear up some of the confusion about this cannibalization mechanism. If the kinetic equilibration is very fast, essentially the temperatures of the two sectors stay together, very coupled. So this is, I'm showing this case here. So here's the evolution of a dark pion number density, comoving number density as a function of a time variable. And here's the dark sector temperature. So here you see that the pions decouple from equilibrium distribution at some the usual like x of 20. And the temperature decouples much later. So this means that kinetic equilibrium is achieved for much longer than chemical equilibrium. And you get sort of a very familiar picture. In the regime where you have, if you turn down the scattering, if you turn down this epsilon, so the exchange of heat isn't as efficient, the kinetic decoupling happens before chemical decoupling. So this is shown here. This is a different set of parameters where the scattering is much less efficient. So here you have, you start out with the temperatures of the two sectors being the same. Kinetic decoupling happens at around x equals 10. So at this point, basically you are no longer able to dump the heat from these cannibalization reactions into the standard model. So we're continually heating up the dark sector. So as a result, the temperature evolves much slower than the standard model. So effectively, the dark sector gets much, much hotter than the standard model. And eventually, freeze out happens at some point. And the upshot is that you end up with having too much dark matter. So this bound really corresponds to overclosing the universe. So out here, you just can't get the dark matter number density, energy density, to be small enough. So to answer your question, or to maybe help out with that question a little bit, if you imagine that equilibrium, kinetic equilibrium was never attained, which is what the focus of his original work on cannibalization was, imagine that this line continued essentially forever until matter radiation equality effectively. So at that point, dark matter temperature is effectively much larger than the standard model. So when dark matter freezes out, it's much hotter. And it doesn't have that time to redshift away to become really cold.
What is the simplest model you can have? You know, this picture. You have this SU and C. We have three gauge groups. There's an extra U1.
There's two gauge groups. So there's the confining gauge group.
Yeah.
And then there's the U1 dark, which I'm using to couple it to.
Is there flavor?
Yeah, there's flavor. So
how many particles do you need? How complex is the sector?
So people originally constructed these to realize this interaction. In order to have this, you need at least five different states. I'm going to focus on the case where there are three flavors. So there's either three quarks or eight light pions, just like in a standard model. I think the smallest possible flavor sector you can have has like five.
Five pions.
Yeah, it's a different gauge group. It's a SP2 gauge group. I forget how the counting goes in that case. But what you're asking is whether you can realize this in an even simpler model. So people have tried. You can try to do it with a scalar basically, or with a couple different scalars. So. And if you just have some scalars, you can think of building up this 3-2 interaction like this. It turns out that the couplings that you need here are very large, so it's not clear whether this theory is actually perturbative or not. The reason why you need large couplings is because this rate is essentially suppressed by 2 powers of a number density. So you need to compensate. This would actually be a similar challenge for this kind of models because, you need to have some large couplings. So the reason why people consider this class of models is because these naturally contain a large coupling. Right, so I've assembled a bunch of ingredients. You can now go ahead and...
So when you say they have a large coupling, but they don't amongst the products, right? The quarks have large coupling. So how big does the coupling have to be to do what you want to do in this model?
This is what this slide is about.
There you go.
Yeah. So now that we have all the ingredients, we can go ahead and actually figure out which region of parameter space give you the correct relic abundance. So there are several processes that contribute to getting the correct relic abundance. So first, there's this 3-2 cannibalization reaction that originally motivated the construction of these models. What we've discovered is that there's another process that's really important as well, and this is the semi-annihilation of a pion of 2 pions into a vector meson and another pion, which actually tends to dominate for large regions of parameter space. These rates depend on two parameters of interest. One is m pi over f pi. This is essentially the coupling constant that I'm talking about. In this sector, so it multiplies each of these rates by some power. And the other parameter that controls this rate is the ratio of the vector mesons to the pions. So you can imagine that if you make these vector mesons very heavy, this kind of process turns off, and you end up with this pure 3-2 case, which is what people studied originally. So you can go ahead and compute the parameters for which you get the correct relic abundance, which is shown here. As a function of a pion mass, dark matter mass, and this coupling on the y-axis. So let's just focus on the red line. This corresponds to decoupling this process. So this is the original simple strongly interacting mass of particles, but only have this cannibalization reaction. So there are two important points here, is that, first of all, the couplings that you need are very large. You very rapidly get to m pi over f pi of 4 pi, which is the sort of the perturbative cutoff for this class of theories. The other point is that this coupling also controls dark matter self-interactions. So you're actually bounded by self-interactions at low masses and perturbativity at high masses. And the actual window in which you can realize this kind of mechanism is very narrow. It's like 100 MeV or something. However, once you include this process, i.e. you sort of bring down the vector mesons in mass, the region of parameter space opens up in which you can realize this kind of dark sector. So here I'm showing the contours of correct relic abundance for different masses of the vector mesons. So you can see that depending on the vector meson mass, you can essentially cover the entire parameter space. But in principle, this can go out to very large masses. So just to emphasize this point, in the original models, the sort of the window where these theories were viable dark matter candidates was like 100 MeV. So here I'm showing a plot from one of the original papers where you have m pi over f pi on the x-axis, pion mass, m pi over f pi on the y-axis, pion mass on the x-axis. The blue band here corresponds to the region where this model actually gives you the correct relic abundance. It's constrained by self-interactions here and perturbativity here. So you can see that you have viable dark matter basically within around 100 MeV. And once you include all of the relevant processes, this region is expanded. And in principle, you can have much more viable parameter space. So the reason why I'm spending a bit of time on this plot is because I wanted to emphasize that the couplings that you need are still kind of large. So you need m pi over f pi to be of order a few. And this has implications for the kinds of spectra that you expect. So for effective field theory, we expect that the vector mesons lie at the cutoff of chiral perturbation theory that describes this dark sector. So, and you can estimate this cutoff. This cutoff goes roughly like 4 pi over f pi. And if you divide this out by m pi, you find that the sort of a typical mass ratio, as you expect, given the relic abundance calculations that I've just shown, where you needed f pi, m pi over f pi of a few, are typically below or like hovering around twice, around 2. So this means the vector mesons can be either above or below 2 m pi. The reason why this is important is because if you produce these dark sector states, these vector mesons in an experiment, if they're above this threshold of 2 m pi, they can decay invisibly into two dark matter particles. If they're below, they're forced to decay visibly into the standard model. So since we can't calculate the spectrum from first principles, unless you have some sort of a lattice simulation, we're going to consider three different possibilities for the different spectra that you can potentially obtain in this class of models. So in the first class of models, you have all vector mesons lie above this 2 m pi threshold. So if they're produced, they can decay invisibly. Oh, so let me also mention another detail. So just like in the standard model, there's going to be some vector mesons that are either charged under the U1 dark or they're neutral. The reason why this separation is useful is because the neutral states, if they can decay to the standard model, then they decay via two-body reactions, so directly into, say, a pair of fermions. Whereas if the charged states, because their decays have to conserve U1 dark, they have to decay into a final state that contains a dark matter pion, which is also charged. So these reactions are three-body, they're phase-space suppressed, so the corresponding lifetime is much longer. So that's why the separation is useful. So the three kinds of spectra you can consider are ones where you have all vector mesons above this 2 m pi threshold, which means they all decay invisibly. Another kind of set of possibilities where the neutral vector mesons are below and charged are above. So in this class, two-body decays into the standard model are possible, while the charged states decay invisibly. And finally, if all vector mesons are below this 2 m pi, then they can decay visibly.
So in cosmology, like your vector meson also decay to standard model fermions. Where you have like this.
I mean, it depends on what mass it has, right? If
so, your assuming it mixes with the photon, so it decays to photons.
Sometimes
it decays with photons, but maybe too slow.
No.
No, if it's above the electron threshold, yeah, it must be. It's 100 MeV, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everything is above the electron threshold.
Yeah.
So we want to look at the signals of these models at Fixarian experiments, so we want these to decay into at least electrons.
But that rate is that rate very large, like during, say, like
BBN.
Matter radiation equality, BBN?
Yeah, it's large. I mean, it's governed by like alpha dark, epsilon, and strong coupling.
Much electrons into the...
No, these states aren't around during BVN, they've decayed completely. This rate is fairly large. I mean, it gives you lifetime decay lengths on the order of like centimeters maybe at most. But it's much too fast for these states to be around.
It's heavier than BVN.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So
the baryons in those sectors have annihilated away.
The baryons?
Yeah.
So that's a working assumption. In principle,
it's not clear because if everything freezes out, then yeah.
Sorry.
Do you have leftover baryon population?
Not if they don't have an asymmetry, they would have all annihilated away, right?
Or to pions, right?
Yeah, I mean, that annihilation rate is strong and very fast.
And you're assuming they're heavier, so.
Yeah, and there's no asymmetry. So, I mean, another maybe important point is that for some of this parameter space, the coupling m pi over f pi is somewhat large. So that means the variants might not be that far separated from the rest of the states, in which case I don't think these models, the predictions for these models will be modified, essentially. But we're not taking that into account. We've assumed that the baryons are decoupled. You can also consider different kinds of limits. For example, in the large ends, you limit the coupling, the baryons decouple. So think there are ways to realize this minimal setup, where you only have the pions and the vector mesons that are important. So I want to talk about the experimental signals. And the way you access this dark sector is through a mediator A prime. So in order to do that, then we have to look at the branching fractions of A prime into the dark sector states. The decays of A prime are more or less democratic. So you can decay either into the dark matter pions or the vector mesons. And these branching fractions are essentially order one through for a bunch of parameters of interest. So remember, we're interested in n pi over f pi of order few, where sort of the different branching fractions are comparable. Here, I've separated the branching fraction into all vector mesons from the branching fraction into the neutral vector mesons. So these states decay via two-body decays, as shown here, as I've drawn there. And the point I want to make is that these decays can be the macroscopic. So this is the decay length of these states as a function of the vector meson mass. So you can see for vector meson masses of like 100 MeV, this is a macroscopic decay. So if this state is produced with some velocity or some boost, it can travel a significant distance before decaying. So we can look for displaced vertices from these decays. So the production of dark photons have been studied extensively over the last 10 years or so. So there are different ways of producing these, either at colliders, such as E plus and minus colliders, like the Barr and Bell, through these kinds of diagrams. I want to focus on electron fixed target experiments, where the production mode is through electron Bremsstrahlung. So you radiate off a dark photon when an electron collides with a nucleus. At hadron colliders or at proton beam dumps, you also have additional production mechanisms where you have Drell-Yan, for example, QQ bar annihilation, or dark photon production from meson decays. Celine first.
I just wanted to add, we were doing that with you, so 2001, I've forgotten, using LEP, so the diagram where you have plus and minus, but with Bremsstrahlung of Z prime, dark photon, but with LEP. So
okay, yeah, I'll add that citation.
No, it's not about the citation. I just wanted to say about LEP. I mean, you also have a constraint from LEP.
Mm-hmm.
From old times.
For missing photon, missing energy, or monophoton?
Energy, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, the CERN has been doing for years missing energy experiments, looking, for example, for Z primes. They see nothing. I mean, you have to be able to experiment and see something to establish this.
So the virtue of these dark sectors is they don't just give you missing energy. They also give you visible signals that you can observe. I mean, in the parameter space of these models, the existing experiments had some constraint, right? That doesn't mean the model is completely ruled out. It means there's just the region of parameter space that gives you a signal is different now. And these experiments are continually improving and pushing down.
Well, that's one explanation.
Well, I guess the other nice thing is that this model contains a finite parameter space. So if these experiments reach this sort of floor, then you can more or less definitively say that this is not dark matter. And that's, that's doing science, basically. But then you can rule out and move on with your life to some other explanation. Yeah.
Do you get like a pion, pion to pion, E plus E minus,
Yeah, pi to, yeah.
Like you go through like an off shell, like a vector meson.
Yeah, yeah, you would have that. So the...
Is large?
You mean this?
Yeah.
No, like a pi to like pi e plus e minus.
E plus e minus? Pi pi, e plus e minus?
No, pi, like, you had this like pi, like a vector meson, like a vertex, right?
Sure, I mean, you can include all the diagrams. I've drawn one.
Okay. I don't know which one is like a bigger rate. Well,
yeah,
you can play with the coupling of like a...
Yeah, I mean, you can...
Of a dark, right? But like, this one is harder.
This one is harder, it's suppressed by epsilon and suppressed by alpha dark. And this isn't the dominant, so Lacurian indirect detection constraints, typically, let's say, constrain cross sections of order of a thermal value. And this process would be much lower than thermal value because we're determining the relic abundance through other means, through these direct sector interactions. So this process can be much smaller than the current sensitivity of indirect detection. You don't seem convinced.
I'm not sure. Like, I'm just asking.
Yeah. I guess what I'm saying is there is no irreducible signal in this case. I'm sure once you...
No, there must be, right? As you said, because if you depend on the mass, there is a fixed mixing you have with the standard model sector. So there must be some sort of minimum irreducible signal, as you call it. It may not be too large, but there may be still an irreducible.
Yeah, I guess my point is that you can make epsilon, which controls this rate,
very small.
Very small. I mean, there's this lower bound.
Yeah. This is all I'm saying. Yeah.
Yeah. You're that's right. You're absolutely right. I think this signal is too low to be constrained in a reasonable way by existing searches. So, I want to talk about fixed target experiments. The reason why they're interesting in this context and looking for new sort of light HG sub GeV scale states is because of this fact: the cross section for production of a dark photon is enhanced by Z squared, where Z. I'm from Canada. I shouldn't be making these mistakes. The Z is a nuclear charge, so it's a number of like of order 100 squared. That's gives you a factor of 10,000 enhancement. So this means the cross sections for production of these dark photons can be very large. So you get a boost in your signal rate. Fixed target experiments also have forward kinematics, which you can use to either reduce backgrounds or to make states displaced. And I'll touch on that in a second. And you have a potential for very large luminosities. You can dump a whole lot of electrons or protons or whatever on target and probe really small couplings. So a couple of comments about the sort of kinematic features of production of dark photons at A prime, or at fixed target colliders, rather. If a dark photon is emitted with respect to a beam with some angle, this angle turns out to be very small. So the production is very forward peaked. This is shown here in this histogram for a particular mass point. So you can see that most of the events come in a direction that's very close to the beam axis. And the other point is that the products, the dark photon and its decay products end up being very boosted because they soak up most of the beam energy, which is shown here in this histogram. So you see most of the events end up having a sort of order one fraction of the beam energy. So this means if they're sort of lighter than the energy of the beam, they have a large boost. And this helps to make particles that maybe are a little bit long-lived traverse great distances. So the signal that, putting everything together, the signal that I want to talk about at fixed target experiments looks like this. So you have you brem off a dark photon. The dark photon decays promptly into a vector meson and a pion. The vector meson is long-lived because of this boost and in part, because of various couplings in the model. It travels a macroscopic distance and decays into U plus E minus or some other pair of Stermel fermions, which you can then observe. So what's interesting in these models is that you can have a large production rate, which is controlled by one set of parameters, and a displaced vertex, which is controlled by a different set of parameters. So you can have large production and large displacement. So this is different from more minimal models where you have the same parameter that controls the lifetime and the production rate, which is sort of a case where that people have been focused on so far.
Can you tell the two apart? So let's say you discover something, can you tell, can you, how would you know that the same brand that you discover is connected to your dark sector?
Sorry, what do you mean? Whether you can distinguish?
Yeah, I can imagine that A prime mixes with the photon, same way it's produced, and then it decays to a plus and minus. They are connected, of course.
That's right. So, I mean, suppose it's a minimal dark photon model, right? So then there's some epsilon that controls both the decay rate and the production rate. If you're in a region of parameter space that gives you a displaced vertex, but it's much too long for a production rate we observe, you can rule out the minimal dark photon explanation. You can also, if you have some way of sort of measuring the total final energy and this recoil electron, then you can tell whether there's some missing energy, for example. So you can see if there's missing extra states that are being produced that you don't actually observe. I mean, that's very hard to do, but in principle, you can use it as a handle.
Can you tell the lifetime of your V, would it decay after BBN into electron?
No, no.
So it's, you don't feel the gap between BBN and
no, there's no problem with BBN. These states decay promptly with respect to BBN.
So I was just asking, because if you do annihilate into, or you produce plus or minus, you still see a small deviation in the CMB spectrum. You change an F.
Yeah, but these states aren't around during recombination. Right, so let's say the typical lifetimes that I'm thinking about here are of order centimeters, which is much shorter compared to 1 second for BBN. Yeah, they're completely gone by the time of BBN, and especially recombination. So I want to talk about some about existing experiments that have sort of covered, that have explored these models. One experiment that frequently comes up is an old slack beam dump called E137. This is a 20 GeV electron beam on an aluminum target. So what makes this experiment so powerful is they dumped an enormous amount of electrons on target. So 30 coulombs worth, which is around 10 to the 20 electrons on target, which is huge. The setup of the experiment was the following. So you had beam coming in, hitting an aluminum target. There's a 200 meter hill, which acted as a shield, so it filtered out any garbage, and another 200 meters of open air where a long-lived particle can decay into standard model particles, which then can then travel and be detected at the detector, which was an electromagnetic calorimeter. So you're looking for very displaced decays of long-lived particles. I guess one interesting factoid here is that there's an older beam dump, E56, which is not famous because it's, or just not interesting because it discovered anything. They were looking for something, for something like heavy neutrinos, but they had a very honest research proposal, which probably wouldn't work in these day, in these days. But this, I mean, this still holds true for most of the experiments done today.
The satellite also would not be true, right? It's not going to involve that much.
Their cost was, they go into the cost, and it's probably like of order hundreds of thousands of dollars, I think, which is a lot by 60s or 70s standards, I think. But it was a Cold War, it was okay. You can spend money on this sort of thing. The constraints and the signal projections that I'm going to show all have a very characteristic shape that has a simple physical origin. So in this parameter space of MA prime and epsilon, the exclusion bounds or sensitivity of experiments I want to show all have this shape. So this shape comes from two factors. One is the production rate for dark photons, which is scales like this. And the other factor is the probability of decaying outside of a shield and before your detector. So it's the difference of exponentials. So Z min is the distance to sort of the far edge of your shield. You want to decay after Z min, but before Z max, which is the distance to your detector. So you can, if you decay inside the shield, you don't record those events. If you decay after your detector, you also don't record those events. So this contour comes from a product of essentially these two factors times the luminosity. As you go to larger epsilon, the lifetime of these long-lived states decreases, so they start to decay before the shield, and you get exponentially penalized by this factor here. As you go in the opposite direction, to smaller epsilon, the lifetime is very long, and you can simplify this with the mass canceling, giving you the sort of flat behavior here. So you can use this sort of signal to and put the resulting constraints on in this parameter space, which is shown here. So here I'm showing a couple of different beam dumps, or say any 137, there are many others, which have sort of comparable sensitivity. So you see that these rule out regions here. And the interesting thing is actually already sensitive down to this region that's excluded by the requirement of having kinetic equilibrium. So you can pretty robustly say that in this region, these experiments probe this kind of scenario. So I've chosen parameters here in such a way that the correct relic abundance is obtained along this line here. But in principle, you can move this around without significantly changing the experimental sensitivity.
Where is the bound for cold dark, hot dark, warm dark matter? Sorry, there should be a bound here. Is it
bigger? It's much below the...
Much below what is shown here?
Yeah, I mean, this is... Here, my dark matter particles are a third of the mass of a dark photon.
Yeah.
So this is, the lowest masses that I have are tens of MeV.
So I'm still confused now, going back to the beginning. Here there's no kinetic equilibrium, so the coupling to the standard model is not there.
In below this line, yeah.
Below this line, yeah.
Yeah.
So the question is, going back, because I'm just confused about what you said in the beginning. There is a big part of the parameter space where there is no warm dark matter here, in this 3 to 2.
So there is no warm dark matter?
Yeah, there's no warm dark matter constraint here, right? You argue that you need the coupling to the standard model to avoid warm dark matter constraints. That was your initial argument.
That was a little too fast. So that argument was basically built around the assumption that suppose there is no coupling to a standard model at all, like not even a little bit. Here, dark matter is still cold. It's just you have too much of it, because here what's setting the relic abundance is not your chemical decoupling, but your kinetic decoupling, and that happens much before x of 20, which is what you need to get the correct relic abundance.
Sorry.
So what you want is way below it.
Yeah.
Like smaller epsilon.
Much smaller epsilon.
Yeah.
For the same mass, because this line goes down.
That's right.
So why? I mean, no. So to continue. I'm just confused about the number of assumptions and part of the.
Sorry, but in this parameter space for these masses, all this line represents is essentially an overclosure bound. Below this line, you can't possibly get the correct relic abundance. You have too much dark matter.
If you're on the red line, you get the right relic abundance.
That's right. Yeah.
So if you're
okay. Sorry. This should stop here. This red line should stop. We should go to the gray boundary and stop. It's just the way I've drawn it.
No, like there's like this this line that is going like this. You should like the red line didn't go below because it's like this is all overclosed, right?
This is all overclosed.
This is all overclosed. I'm sorry. I shouldn't have drawn.
Not extend below non-kinetic.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, this is...
Sorry,
this is
I'm just confused. Yeah.
This has been a poorly drawn figure. I've updated since, but I forgot to update it in the presentation. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
This parameter space is just not viable.
The line won't get modified, so you just
here?
Follow the line, so it gets... So you follow... How does the red line end on non-kinetic equilibrium? Does it follow the curve? For the masses, or does it
yeah, that's right. So Along these lines, you can potentially get the correct relic abundance.
Okay.
So this is what's called a elastically decoupling relic, or this elder. I don't know if you've...
I haven't followed
Okay, so I guess Yudai was here at some point. Maybe he talked about it.
Yeah.
So the limit between... So here you have simps. Along this line, this boundary, you have elders. So
that red line extends in both directions that way.
Yeah. But there, once you're in this elder regime, there is this constraint. You need cannibalization to last longer than... You need cannibalization to be on for a long time, which means mpi over fpi has to be large. So you might run into perturbativity constraints, basically.
Oh.
So I'm saying that if you really want to live along that line, it's not going to be the case that the entire parameter space is open. At some point, you're going to hit perturbativity.
No, that's fine. But there is some extent. That line doesn't continue on straight. It goes either... It starts going on that non-kinetic equilibrium, right?
Yes. But, you would have to play with the other couplings. Yeah, so they're viable dark matter models living along this boundary between the two regions. Having said that, I should say that we're currently trying to work out this line more carefully, so it will shift up and down a little bit. Okay, I'm rapidly running out of time. Let me just mention the other set of experiments that appear in these kinds of plots. There are experiments looking for dark matter scattering that's been produced in proton beam dumps. So you can have a dark photon produced in a beam dump experiment like I've described, which then decays into a pair of dark matter pions. And if you put a detector far downstream, you can look for scattering of these dark matters, dark boosted dark matter particles off nuclei. And this work has been first pioneered by Maxim and his collaborators. And this rules out sort of regions parameter space up here. The other important constraint that appears is Babar, the Babar search to invisibly decaying dark photons, which is any plexi minus going to a monophoton. And this rules out this parameter space up here. So there's obviously a gap in the parameter space here. In order to see what kinds of experiments we're actually able to probe the gap, it's useful to convert this into a different set of parameters, to put the physical decay length of a dark sector states on the y-axis, which essentially involves flipping this plot upside down, like so. So here I have a decay length of these states. So you can see that the gap appears for decay lengths of order a centimeter, essentially. And the natural conclusions that you need to experiment with baselines, experimental baselines of order a centimeter. So fortunately, there are experiments that already exist that can do this search, and also experiments that can be built in the near future that will also be sensitive to this class of models. So let me just briefly describe what these are. There is a dark photon search called the heavy photon search. This is an electron fixed target experiment where you have an electron coming in, hitting a thin target, which then hopefully producing a displaced decay of a dark photon into E plus E minus. The electrons and positrons are tracked, and then their energy is measured by a calorimeter over here. They have some data set which has some large number of event samples, and there's a potential future run at higher energies and higher luminosities. So you can sort of evaluate what the signal is for this kind of model, where you have a displaced decay now, not of a dark photon, but of a dark vector mesons, and you find that this kind of search will be sensitive to a region of parameter space over here, precisely in this gap. Looking towards the future, there's a proposed experiment called LDMX, which has been pioneered by Philip and Natalia, as well as their postdocs. So the idea, sort of the purpose of this experiment is not to look for displaced decays, but rather for missing energy signals. So the idea is to have an incoming electron, which is tagged, so its energy is and momentum are precisely measured. It hits some target, after which its energy and momentum are again measured. So a signal in this experiment would correspond to observing an outgoing electron that has a large fraction of its energy missing and nothing else in the detector. So in order to determine that there's really nothing else produced, you need a huge detector of order sort of 3 meter scale or something to capture any potential sort of radiation that has been produced. So what we figured out is that you can actually use the size of the detector to look for similar display signals as well. So the idea is to have this collision produce a vector meson which then travels far into the detector, so several radiation lengths where you don't have any backgrounds, and decay into visible states which give you some electromagnetic shower. So the signal is a display shower. And if you go far enough, you really don't have any backgrounds because these any potential electromagnetic backgrounds fall off exponentially fast. The sensitivity of this experiment, LDMX, is shown here. So this is the search for visible signals. This is a slightly different baseline compared to HPS, so you see that it's shifted up a little bit. There's also the potential sensitivity of the invisible signals that LDMX is sensitive to, as well as projections for this Bell 2 experiment, which is another B factory. OK, I'm running out of time, so let me 5 minutes? OK. I focused on this sort of special spectrum where the only decays into the visible sector come from two-body decays of vector mesons. If you allow for three-body decays, this leads to a qualitatively different picture where because this decay length, the decay length of these states, of these charge states that decay via three-body decays, is much larger. So here I've shown the decay length as a function of vector meson mass. And you can see that it's like factor of 10,000 longer for these charge states. So this means that long baseline experiments are very, very important and very sensitive to this kind of model. And indeed, if you look at, for example, constraints from E137, it turns out for epsilons of 10 to minus 3, 10 to minus 4, the decay length of these charge states is in perfect optimal range for E137. So it ends up swallowing a bunch of this parameter space. So new experiments don't really have a chance. Or sorry, new experiments with a small, of a type that I've shown, that I've discussed before. I mean, one, this is really a sort of a small lie, since these plots are always shown on a logarithmic scale but emphasize the reach of fixed target experiments. In reality, if you plot this on a linear scale, there's a whole range of parameter space that's open and can be accessed potentially with colliders. Good. I was a little bit quick with this. So here I've actually fixed the relic abundance to be correct in the entire parameter space.
By changing
m pi over f pi.
Oh.
That's right. So the plots with the red line have fixed m pi over f pi to a single value.
And you're assuming it's perturbative all the way through the plot?
I'm not assuming. I know what m pi over f pi is at every point, and it's perturbative.
No, you've chosen to be perturbative.
That's right. Yeah. So if you remember that plot with the contours of relic abundance, I fixed m pi over f pi to one of those contours, effectively. Since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to talk about colliders. But in principle, you should be able to access that region there as well. So let me just conclude by saying that I've motivated these strongly interacting dark sectors. They potentially offer an alternative paradigm to the usual sort of weakling tracking dark sectors. There are novel production mechanisms and interesting new signals, but typically feature displaced decays of new particles into standard model particles. And the parameter space that you have access to is limited from the bottom from this requirement of kinetic equilibrium, which means, in principle, with a reasonable set of experiments, you can potentially completely rule out the scenario, or test the scenario, rather, and hopefully discover something. Okay, thank you. Yeah, that's right. So I've shown only a limited set of experiments on these plots for simplicity mainly, but NA64 actually lives inside this dark matter scattering blob, which is why I didn't display it. Yeah.
But it's for like muon electron beam.
Yeah, so NA64 is the 100 GeV electron beam on a target, and it's a missing mass experiment. So it's somewhat analogous to this LDMX thing, where you measure the incoming electron energy, and then measure the outgoing electron energy, and you try to see events where most of the energy is gone somewhere. Yep.
Yep. It's not like you predict with these kind of models, like, you know, cosmology, that would be non-particle physics signals. Or is this going to look like all of them?
So I'm not showing these contours, but so these models are strongly interacting in the sense that this coupling m pi over f pi is fairly large. This coupling also controls the self-interactions of dark matter. So if you were to plot the self-interaction cross-section, it'd be something like 1 cm² per gram here. That's kind of in the region interesting for sort of Bully cluster and other astrophysical probes. So if you were to find a signal here, which would be already kind of tough considering its intention with existing Earth-based searches, in principle, you could probably look for something like that. But other than that, I don't think there's anything particularly novel from a cosmology side of view or astrophysical.
Yeah. So if we improve, you're saying, so I mean, you know, the bounds on dark matter self interactions from things like the Bully cluster, like future improvements, so then, that'll move how much? So 0.1, for example, some of your square program would be like roughly where?
Around here. Actually, maybe I might have it in some of the backup slides.
The one that had the like curves going up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I guess I have it in the relic abundance plot. That's right. Yeah, so.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And your dark photons are too massive to be probed by ineffective in CMB.
Yeah, that's right. So these are for the masses that I've considered. The CMB constraints sort of, or sorry, ineffective constraints peter out at like tens of MeV. So I think if you were to go below this, you would also be hit by self-interactions as well. So you'd have two problems to deal with. That's why most of these plots are cut off at 10 to minus 2 GeV.
Questions?
So how parameters are 5, right? Three parameters. So you have MV over M pi. There is M pi. There is M pi over F pi. There is the MA prime, and there is the kinetic mixing. So there's 5 parameters.
And alpha dark.
Eh?
Alpha dark. A dark.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Oh, 6. Okay.
Yeah.
So the question is, will you be able to know that this is your model of dark matter? Let's say you discover an A prime. And
I'm saying that's already good enough. No, I'm joking.
Yeah, I mean,
you're only happy to discover an A prime. I agree with you.
But no, not in this mass range, right?
So the question is, so what would be the smoking gun?
Okay.
This is how
so I think,
a strong sector that cannibalizes, and there is an A prime that radiates the coupling to us. What is the smoking gun of this?
So I think at colliders, you can, if you say have a discovery at E plus E minus, so there, this kind of dark sector would manifest itself as sort of a shower of hidden sector particles. From that, you can learn about the flavor structure and the confinement scale, right? And from the fact that you have a shower, you can actually tell that this is really a confining dark sector.
Oh, you can talk about the shower.
Yeah, I ran out of time.
Okay. Show us your shower.
Well, that's potential future work of, I can show you a picture of it.
Yeah.
Of, artist's depiction of what it would look like. So the idea is that if you are like at a collider with a center of mass energy much larger or larger than the confinement scale, you really produce a pair of dark sector quarks, which is then shower producing a jet of dark sector mesons, some of which are invisible, some of which decay visibly. So by looking at the shape of a shower, you can deduce, you can measure the confinement scale. So for example, if a confinement scale is much smaller than the center of mass energy, you end up with a pair of pencil-like jets, which are very collimated, simply because the sort of a transverse opening of these jets are given by essentially the confinement scale over their boost, which is set by the center of mass energy. Whereas if you have a more spherical jet, then the confinement scale is comparable to the center of mass energy. And by looking at sort of the fraction of invisible decays versus the fraction of visible decays, you can sort of learn stuff about the flavor structure. So this is something I want to think about in the future, which is why I'm being somewhat vague. At the fixed target level, you can learn that in all of these cases that I've talked about, there's an additional particle that's being produced, this pion that goes missing. So if you're really able to measure the recoil particle in the fixed target collision precisely and deduce that there's also, aside from a visible component, there's also a missing component, you can learn that it's not a minimal scenario, such as a dark photon. So it's another handle, but of course, none of these experiments also tell you that this is dark matter. It just tells you that there's some long-lived particle. So really what you would need to do is to also observe it in like a direct detection experiment, which is also possible with some future technologies at these light masses. So I think with a combination of experiments, you can sort of can begin to convince yourself that a setup like this is really true in nature, as realized in nature, but any one experiment will probably have trouble. Because a lot of these signals can also be realized in sort of more minimal models by themselves.
The question is the sum of all parts.
Yeah.
It's like this.